28. "I shouldn't go," said the consul. He and Saul had carried the still unconscious Het-Mastine from the cave tomb to the Sphinx, while Father Duret watched over Braun Lamia. It was almost midnight, and the valley glowed from the reflected light of the tombs. The wings of the Sphinx cut arcs from the bit of sky visible to them between the cliff walls. Braun lay motionless, the obscene cable snaking into the darkness of the tomb. Saul touched the consul's shoulder.
"We've discussed it. You should go."
The consul shook his head and idly stroked the ancient hawking mat.
"It may be able to carry two. You and Duret could make it to where the Benares is tied up."
Saul held his daughter's small head in the cusp of his hand as he gently rocked her.
"Rachel is 2 days old. Besides, this is where we must be."
The consul looked around. His eyes showed his pain.
"This is where I should be. The shrike."
Duret leaned forward. The luminescence from the tomb behind them painted his high forehead and sharp cheeks with light.
"My son, if you stay here, it is for no other reason than suicide. If you attempt to bring the ship back for M. Lamia and the Templar, you will be helping others."
The consul rubbed his cheek. He was very tired.
"There's room for you on the mat, father."
Duret smiled.
"Whatever my fate may be, I feel that I am meant to meet it here. I will wait for your return."
The consul shook his head again, but moved to sit cross-legged on the mat, pulling the heavy duffel bag toward him. He counted the ration packs and water bottles Saul had packed for him.
"There are too many. You'll need more for yourself."
Duret chuckled.
"We have enough food and water for 4 days, thanks to M. Lamia. After that, if we have to fast, it will not be the first time for me."
"But what if Silenus and Cassad return?"
"They can share our water," said Saul. "We can make another trip to the keep for food if the others return."
The consul sighed. "All right." He touched the appropriate flight thread designs, and the 2 meters of carpet stiffened and rose 10 centimeters above the stone. If there was a wobble in the uncertain magnetic fields, it was not discernible.
"You'll need oxygen for the mountain crossing," said Saul.
The consul lifted the osmosis mask from the pack. Saul handed him Lamia's automatic pistol.
"I can't. It won't help us with the shrike," said Saul. "And it might make the difference of whether you get to Keats or not."
The consul nodded and set the weapon in his bag. He shook hands with the priest, then with the old scholar. Rachel's tiny fingers brushed his forearm.
"Good luck,"
said Duret.
"May God be with you."
The consul nodded, tapped the flight designs, and leaned forward as the hawking mat lifted 5 meters, wobbled ever so slightly, and then slid forward and up as if riding invisible rails in the air. The consul banked right toward the entrance to the valley, passed 10 meters above the dunes there, and then banked left toward the barrens. He looked back only once. The 4 figures on the top step of the Sphinx, 2 men standing, 2 shapes reclining, looked very small indeed. He could not make out the baby in Saul's arms. As they had agreed, the consul aimed the hawking mat toward the west to overfly the city of poets in hopes of finding Martin Silenus. Intuition told him that the irascible poet might have detoured there. The skies were relatively free of the light of battle, and the consul had to search shadows unbroken by starlight as he passed 20 meters above the broken spires and domes of the city. There was no sign of the poet. If Braun and Silenus had come this way, even their footprints in the sand had been erased by the night winds, which now moved the consul's thinning hair and flapped his clothing. It was cold on the mat at this altitude. The consul could feel the shudders and vibrations as the hawking mat felt its way along unsteady lines of force. Between Hyperion's treacherous magnetic field and the age of the EM flight threads, he knew that there was a real chance the mat would tumble out of the sky long before he reached the capital of Keats. The consul shouted Martin Silenus's name several times, But there was no response, except for an explosion of doves from their nesting place in the shattered dome of one of the gallerias. He shook his head and banked south toward the bridal range. Through his grandfather Merrin, the consul knew the history of this hawking mat. It had been one of the first such playthings handcrafted by Vladimir Sholokhov, web-famous lepidopterist and EM systems engineer, and it may well have been the one he gave to his teenaged niece. Sholokhov's love for the young girl had become legend, as had the fact that she spurned the gift of the flying carpet. But others had loved the idea, and while hawking mats were soon outlawed on worlds with sensible traffic control, they continued to show up on colonial planets. This one had allowed the consul's grandfather to meet his grandmother Ciri on Maui Covenant. The consul looked up as the mountain range approached. 10 minutes of flying had covered the 2-hour hike across the barrens. The others had urged him not to stop at Kronos Keep to look for Silenus. Whatever fate might have befallen the poet there might well claim the consul, too, before his journey had really begun. He contented himself with hovering just beyond the windows, 200 meters up the cliff wall, an arm's length from the terrace where they had looked out at the valley 3 days before, and shouting for the poet. Only echoes answered him from the dark banquet halls and corridors of the keep. The consul held on tightly to the edges of the hawking mat, feeling the sense of height and exposure this close to the vertical stone walls. He was relieved when he banked the mat away from the keep, gained altitude, and climbed toward the mountain passes where snow gleamed in the starlight. He followed the cables of the tramway as they climbed the pass and connected one 9,000-meter peak to the next, across the wide span of the mountain range. It was very cold at this altitude, and the consul was glad for Kassad's extra thermal cape as he huddled under it, taking care not to expose the flesh of his hands or cheeks. The gel of the osmosis mask stretched across his face like some hungry symbiote, gobbling oxygen where little was to be found. It was enough. The consul took slow, deep breaths as he flew 10 meters above the ice-caked cables. None of the pressurized tram cars were running, and the isolation above the glaciers, sheer peaks, and shadow-shrouded valleys was heart-stopping. The consul was glad that he was attempting this trip, if for no other reason than to see Hyperion's beauty one last time, unspoiled by the terrible threat of the Shrike or Ouster invasion. It had taken the tram car 12 hours to ferry them from south to north. Despite the hawking mat's slow 20-click-per-hour airspeed, the consul made the crossing in 6 hours. Sunrise caught him still above the peaks. He startled awake, realized with a shock that he had been dreaming while the hawking mat flew on toward a peak rising another 5 meters above his altitude. The consul could see boulders and snowfields 50 meters ahead. A black bird with a 3-meter wingspan, one of those the locals called a harbinger, pushed off from its icy eyrie and floated in the thin air, looking back at the consul with black and beady eyes while he banked steeply to the left, felt something give way in the hawking mat's flight gear, and fell 30 meters before the flight threads found purchase and leveled the carpet off. The consul gripped the edges of the mat with fingers gone white. He had tied the strap of his duffel bag around his belt, otherwise the bag would have tumbled off to a glacier far below. There was no sign of the tramway. Somehow the consul had slept long enough to allow the hawking mat to drift off course. For a second he panicked, jinking the mat this way and then that, desperate for a path between the peaks surrounding him like teeth. Then he saw the morning sunlight golden on the slopes ahead of him and to his right, the shadows leaping across glaciers and high tundra behind him and to his left, and he knew that he was still on the right track. Beyond this final spine of high peaks lay the southern foothills, and beyond that, the hawking mat seemed to hesitate as the consul tapped flight designs and urged it higher, but it rose in reluctant steps until it cleared the final 9,000-meter peak, and he could see the lower mountains beyond, dwindling to foothills a mere 3,000 meters above sea level. The consul descended with gratitude. He found the tram line gleaming in sunlight, 8 clicks south of where he left the bridal range. Tram cars hung silently around the West Terminal station. Below, the sparse buildings of the village of Pilgrim's Rest appeared as abandoned as they had several days earlier. There was no sign of the wind wagon, where it had been left at the low pier leading out over the shallows of the sea of grass. The consul let down near the pier, deactivated the hawking mat, stretched his legs with some pain before rolling up the mat for safekeeping, and found a toilet in one of the abandoned buildings near the wharf. When he emerged, the morning sun was creeping down the foothills and erasing the last shadows there. As far as he could see to the south and west stretched the sea of grass, its tabletop smoothness belied by occasional breezes, which sent ripples across the verdant surface, briefly revealing the russet and ultramarine stalks beneath in a movement so wave-like that one expected to see whitecaps and fish leaping. There were no fish in the sea of grass, but there were grass serpents 20 meters long, and if the consul's hawking mat failed him out there, even a safe landing would not keep him alive for long. The consul unrolled the mat, set his bag behind him, and activated the carpet. He stayed relatively low, 25 meters above the surface, but not so low that a grass serpent might mistake him for a low-flying morsel. It had taken the wind wagon less than a full Hyperion day to ferry them across the sea, but with the winds frequently from the northeast, that had involved quite a bit of tacking to and fro. The consul bet that he could fly across this narrowest part of the sea in less than 15 hours. He tapped the forward control designs, and the hawking mat sped faster. Within 20 minutes, the mountains had fallen behind until the foothills were lost in the haze of distance. Within an hour, the peaks began to shrink as the curve of the world hid their base. 2 hours out, and the consul could see only the highest of the peaks as an indistinct, serrated shadow rising from the haze. Then the sea of grass spread to all horizons, unchanging except for the sensuous ripples and furrows caused by the occasional breeze. It was much warmer here than on the high plateau north of the Bridal Range. The consul shed his thermal cape, then his coat, then his sweater. The sun beat down with surprising intensity for such high latitudes. The consul fumbled in his bag, found the wrinkled and battered tricorn cap he had worn with such aplomb just 2 days earlier, and wedged it on his head to give some shade. His forehead and balding skull were already sunburned. About 4 hours out, he ate his first meal of the trip, chewing on the tasteless strips of ration-pack protein as if they were filet mignon. The water was the most delicious part of the meal, and the consul had to fight his urge to empty all the bottles in a single orgy of drinking. The sea of grass stretched below, behind, and ahead. The consul dozed, snapping awake each time with a sense of falling, hands gripping the edge of the rigid hawking mat. He realized that he should have tied himself in with the single rope he had brought in his bag, but he didn't want to land. The grass was sharp and higher than his head. Although he had seen none of the telltale V-shaped wakes of the grass serpents, he could not be sure they were not resting in wait below. He wondered idly where the wind wagon had gone. The thing had been fully automated and presumably programmed by the Church of the Shrike, since they had sponsored the pilgrimage. What other duties might the thing have had? The consul shook his head, sat upright, and pinched his cheeks. He had been drifting in and out of dreams, even as he thought about the wind wagon. 15 hours had seemed a short enough time as he stood talking about it in the Valley of the Time Tombs. He glanced at his comm log. 5 hours had passed. The consul lifted the mat to 200 meters, looked carefully for any sign of a serpent, and then brought the mat down to a hover 5 meters above the grass. Carefully, he extracted the rope, made a loop, moved to the front of the carpet, and wound several lengths around the carpet, leaving enough slack to slide his body in before tightening the knot. If the mat fell, the tether would be worse than useless, but the snug bands of rope against his back gave a sense of security as he leaned forward to tap the flight designs again, leveled the carpet out at 40 meters, and laid his cheek against the warm fabric. Sunlight filtered through his fingers, and he realized that his bare forearms were getting a terrible sunburn. He was too tired to sit up and roll down his sleeves. A breeze came up. The consul could hear a rustling and sliding below as either the grasses blew or something large slithered past. He was too tired to care. The consul closed his eyes and was asleep in less than 30 seconds. The consul dreamed of his home, his true home on Maui Covenant, and the dream was filled with color. The bottomless blue sky, the wide expanse of the South Sea, ultramarine fading to green where the equatorial shallows began, the startling greens and yellows and orchid reds of the Motil Islands as they were herded north by the dolphins, extinct now since the hegemony invasion in the consul's childhood, but quite alive in his dream, breaking the water in great leaps that sent 1,000 prisms of light dancing in the pure air. In his dream, the consul was a child again, and he stood on the highest level of a treehouse on their first family isle. Grandmother Siri was next to him, not the regal grande dame he had known, but the beautiful young woman his grandfather had met and fallen in love with. The tree sails were flapping as the southerlies came up, moving the herd of Motil Isles in precise formation through the blue channels through the shallows. Just on the northern horizon, he could see the first of the equatorial archipelago islands rising green and permanent against an evening sky. Siri touched his shoulder and pointed to the west. The isles were burning, sinking, their keel roots writhing in purposeless pain. The consul recognized billion-volt lances as they fried the air and left blue-gray afterimages on his retinas. Underwater explosions lighted the oceans and sent thousands of fish and fragile sea creatures bobbing to the surface in their death throes. "Why?" asked Grandmother Siri, but her voice was the soft whisper of a teenager. The consul tried to answer her but could not. Tears blinded him. He reached for her hand, but she was no longer there, and the sense that she was gone, that he could never make up for his sins, hurt him so badly that he found it impossible to breathe. His throat was clogged with emotion. Then he realized that it was smoke that burned his eyes and filled his lungs. The family isle was on fire. The child who was the consul staggered forward in the blue-black darkness, hunting blindly for someone to hold his hand, to reassure him. A hand closed on his. It was not Ceres. The hand was impossibly firm as it squeezed. The fingers were blades. The consul came awake gasping. It was dark. He had slept for at least 7 hours. Struggling with the ropes, he sat up, stared at his glowing comlog display. 12 hours. He had slept for 12 hours. Every muscle in his body ached as he leaned over and peered below. The hawking mat held a steady altitude of 40 meters, but he had no idea where he was. Low hills rose and fell below. The mat must have cleared some by only 2 or 3 meters. Orange grass and shrub lichen grew in spongy tufts. Somewhere, sometime in the past few hours, he had passed over the south shore of the sea of grass, missed the small port of Edge and the Hooghly River docks where their levitation barge, Benares, had been tied up. The consul had no compass. Compasses were useless on Hyperion, and his comlog had not been programmed as an inertial direction finder. He had planned to find his way back to Keats by following the Hooghly south and west, retracing the laborious path of their upriver pilgrimage minus the bends and turns in the river. Now he was lost. The consul set the hawking mat down on a low hilltop, stepped off to solid ground with a groan of pain, and collapsed the mat. He knew that the charge in the flight threads must be at least 1/3 expended by now, perhaps more. He had no idea how much efficiency the mat lost with age. The hills looked like the rough country southwest of the Sea of Grass, but there was no sight of the river. His comm log told him that it had been dark for only an hour or two, but the consul could see no hint of sunset in the west. The skies were overcast, shielding both starlight and any space battles from sight. "Damn," whispered the consul. He walked around until circulation returned, urinated at the edge of a small drop-off, and returned to his mat to drink from a water bottle. Think. He had set the mat on a southwesterly course that should have left the sea of grass at or near the port city of Edge. If he had simply overflown Edge and the river while he slept, the river would be somewhere to his south, off to his left. But if he had aimed poorly as he left Pilgrim's Rest, been just a few degrees off to his left, then the river would be winding northeast somewhere to his right. Even if he went the wrong way, he eventually would find a landmark, the coast of the northern Maine, if nothing else. But the delay could cost him a full day. The consul kicked at a rock and folded his arms. The air was very cool after the heat of the day. A shiver made him realize that he was half sick from sunburn. He touched his scalp and pulled his fingers away with a curse. Which way? The wind whistled through low sage and sponge lichen. The consul felt very far removed from the time tombs and the threat of the shrike, but he felt the presence of Saul and Dore and Hetmastine and Braun and the missing Silenus and Kassad as an urgent pressure on his shoulders. The consul had joined the pilgrimage as a final act of nihilism, a pointless suicide to put an end to his own pain. Pain at the loss of even the memory of wife and child, killed during the hegemony's machinations on Brescia, and pain at the knowledge of his terrible betrayal, betrayal of the government he had served for almost 4 decades, betrayal of the ousters who had trusted him. The consul sat on a rock and felt that purposeless self-hatred fade as he thought of Saul and his infant child waiting in the valley of the time tombs. He thought of Braun, that brave woman, energy incarnate, lying helpless with that leech-like extension of the shrike's evil growing from her skull. He sat, activated the mat, and rose to 800 meters, so close to the ceiling of clouds that he could have raised a hand and touched them. A second's break in the cloud cover far to his left showed a glint of ripple. The Hooli lay about 5 clicks to the south. The consul banked the hawking mat steeply to his left, feeling the tired containment field trying to press him to the carpet, but feeling safer with the ropes still attached. 10 minutes later, he was high over the water, swooping down to ascertain that it was the broad Hooli rather than some tributary. It was the Hooli. Radiant gossamers glowed in the low, marshy areas along the banks. The tall, crenellated towers of architect ants cast ghostly silhouettes against a sky only slightly darker than the land. The consul rose to 20 meters, took a drink of water from his bottle, and headed downriver at full speed. Sunrise found him below the village of Dukobor's copse, almost to the Karla locks where the Royal Transport Canal cut west toward the northern urban settlements and the Maine. The consul knew that it was less than 150 clicks to the capital from here, but still a maddening 7 hours away at the hawking mat's slow pace. This was the point in the trip where he had hoped to find a military skimmer on patrol, one of the passenger dirigibles from the Copse of Naiad, even a fast powerboat he could commandeer. But there was no sign of life along the banks of the Hooli, except for the occasional burning building or ghee lamps in distant windows. The docks had been stripped of all boats. The river mantapens above the locks were empty, the great gates open to the current, and no transport barges were lined up below where the river widened to twice its upriver size. The consul swore and flew on. It was a beautiful morning, as the sunrise illuminated the low clouds and made every bush and tree stand out in the low, horizontal light. It felt to the consul as if it had been months since he had seen real vegetation. Weirwood and half-oak trees rose to majestic heights on the distant bluffs, while in the floodplain the rich light caught the green shoots of 1,000,000 periscope beans rising from their indigene paddies. Womangrove root and fire fern lined the banks, and each branch and twisting stood out in the sharp light of sunrise. The clouds swallowed the sun. It began to rain. The consul tugged on the battered tricorn, huddled under Kassad's extra cloak, and flew on southward at 100 meters. The consul tried to remember. How long did the child Rachel have? Despite his long sleep the day before, the consul's mind was heavy with fatigue toxins. Rachel had been 4 days old when they had arrived at the valley. That had been 4 days ago. The consul rubbed his cheek, reached for a water bottle, and found them all empty. He could easily dip down and refill the bottles in the river, but he did not want to take the time. His sunburn ached and made him shiver as the rain dripped from his cap. Saul said that as long as I'm back by nightfall, it would be all right. Rachel was born after 2000 hours, translated to Hyperion time. If that's right, if there's no error, she has until 8 tonight. The consul rubbed water from his cheeks and eyebrows. Say 7 more hours to Keats. 1 hour or 2 to liberate the ship. Theo will help. He's governor general now. I can convince him that it's in the hegemony's interest to countervene Gladstone's orders to quarantine the ship. If necessary, I'll tell him that she ordered me to conspire with the ousters to betray the web. Say 10 hours plus the 15-minute flight in the ship. Should be at least 1 hour to spare before sunset. Rachel will be only a few minutes old, but what? What do we try besides the cryogenic fugue lockers? Nothing. It has to be that. It was always Saul's last chance, despite the doctor's warnings that it might kill the child. But then, what about Braun? The consul was thirsty. He pulled back the cloak, but the rain had lessened to the point that it was a fine drizzle, just enough to wet his lips and tongue to make him more thirsty. He cursed softly and began to descend slowly. Perhaps he could hover over the river just long enough to fill his bottle. The hawking mat quit flying 30 meters above the river. 1 second it was descending gradually, as smooth as a carpet on a gentle glass incline, and the next instant it was tumbling and plummeting out of control, a 2-meter rug and terrified man thrown out of the window of a 10-story building. The consul screamed and tried to jump free, but the rope connecting him to the carpet and the duffel strap tied to his belt tangled him in the flapping mass of hawking mat, and he fell with it, tumbling and twisting, the final 20 meters to the hard surface of the waiting Hooghly River.